Hello, everyone. I'm Robbie Dorman, and this is A Serial Fanaticist, the podcast for fans of everything. Welcome. Today, I am joined by Andrew Bloom of theandrewblog.net to talk about Season 2 of Westworld. We talk about robot apocalypses, discuss the sometimes wooden exposition, and also highlight the several superb episodes of the season. I was very excited about Season 2, and I had a lot of fun talking about it with Andrew. This contains spoilers, so don't listen until you've watched Season 2 if you care about that sort of thing. On to the discussion! Hello, everyone. I'm here once again with Andrew Bloom of theandrewblog.net. Andrew, how you doing?
I'm doing very well. I'm questioning whether I could pass the Turing test, but otherwise doing good. How are you, Robbie?
I'm all right. I think about how ill-equipped I would be if I was put in one of these situations with robots and black op military contractors.
Fighting. It's not something you trained for?
No.
Fight off killer robots and strike forces?
No, not really. I haven't really. I'd be the, you know, what's his fate? I can't, I always forget. The
Sizemore?
The writer. Yeah.
Yeah, Sizemore, yeah.
That's, or yeah, me. That's exactly. I'm like, yeah, I wrote that speech and like, then I, oh, don't shoot me.
He gets his moment of badassery.
I guess he does before he. I hesitate to say that anyone is dead anymore on this show, because I was on the record in the first podcast about this, about several people. I was like, oh, they're dead, and they're good as new in the start of Season 2. Now, we're talking about Westworld Season 2. There'll be spoilers. I've already said that once, and I'm saying it again, just to make sure everyone knows. Westworld. Popular HBO drama with killer robots based on the 73 movie written and directed by Michael Crichton.
Starring Yul Brynner.
Starring Yul Brynner. Yeah, exactly. And they believe...
King and I and Ten Commandments fan.
Yeah, Yul Brynner, I believe, it actually makes a small cameo, like, in Season 1. I think they do have, like, a shadowy vision. You get a shadowy, like, cameo of Yul Brynner. Yul Brynner robot.
I was going to say, that's impressive considering he died decades ago.
I mean, I think it's just like CG'd him in there.
It's nice that they do an homage.
Yeah, it is. I appreciate it at the time. My thoughts on Season 1, before we get into Season 2 and dig into all the details, my thoughts on Season 1 are pretty well captured on a Season 1 podcast I did, 2 years ago at this point. But you are not in that podcast, Andrew. So what are your thoughts on the show after Season 1? You know, you watched the first season. What did you think?
So my general impressions on Season 1 is that I found the show pretty trying when it was stringing the audience along with its mystery boxes. I thought many of the performances were good, but I think it spent at least the first 6 episodes or so teasing things and offering cryptic hints and vaguely gesturing at what might be to come. And it just didn't really do it for me. I was waiting for them to get to the fireworks factory. And once they got to episode 7 and started actually unpacking those mystery boxes and letting you in on some of the details of whose motivation was what secret identities people had, what was actually happening, rather than just leaving you the pieces and hoping that maybe you'll put some of them together but be shocked by others, I found the material was very rich, and there was a lot of thematically interesting stuff the show could do. But I feel like I found the pilot really interesting and intriguing, and then felt like the show didn't give us nearly as much as it needed to in episodes 2 through 6. And then when it finally stopped playing the hide the ball game in episode 7 and delivering on these twists and building to something, I liked it a lot better.
Is that overall, is that balance too much weighted in the uneven, boring drawing out the mystery versus reveals, or was it did the reveals justify the uneven, slower episodes with lots of exposition? Because this is going to come up again in season two.
Well, let's put it this way. I thought the reveals were good. I actually had my suspicions about William being the man in black pretty much from the moment that William picked the white hat. So it didn't shock me, but I thought they did a good job laying the groundwork for why that was a shocking transition and a big difference there. It justifies sticking around to see what the answers are, but it still didn't retroactively make episodes 2 through 6 better. I didn't sort of look back on those and say, well, this totally makes sense because they were building to this point. It still felt like they were hiding the ball more than they needed to and not necessarily really building to those reveals as much as they were spinning their wheels and vaguely hinting at them to where it's not a the one justifies the other to me.
Okay. The two big reveals, this is my own personal curiosity, the William and Man in Black stuff. But the other one, Bernard, did you see that coming at all?
I had zero clue on that. I assumed that Arnold was actually like the Tyler Durden alter ego of Ford, and that he had kind of made him up, or Arnold represented his creative side or something like that. But I did not. Or I also had, I briefly had a theory that Arnold was his name for an AI that had been assisting him from the beginning or something like that. But I had no idea that it was actually Bernard, or that Bernard was Arnold, or Bernard-old, or whatever you want to call it.
Bernard-old. I'll be calling him Bernard and only Bernard. Especially in season two, because Arnold basically doesn't appear in season two at all. There's not even a allusion, I don't think, unless I'm mistaken, which is quite possible. What, you'd be like the Chris Gaines to Rob the Ford's Garth Brooks.
So now I'm just imagining Anthony Hopkins in the like Chris Gaines wig. Yeah, no, I've got these robots that really express a different part of my soul.
I always try to shoehorn Chris Gaines references into podcasts.
You gotta stay timely with these things.
Yeah, exactly. It's right on top of things. Yeah, I really like season one. From my general poking at criticism of the show, I think it's generally most people like the show. I think the reviews are generally net positive, but I feel like I have more patience for the reveals than most people. It seems a lot of people don't like that. The slow dribbling of information and the deliberate obfuscation of things because they are holding things back for that reveal. I think I was a little bit more patient with it, a little bit more okay with it. I thought season one, I was, to give you a general idea of how I felt, I thought I was very excited at the end of it. And at no point did I go, I never felt frustrated with the show. I was just enjoying my time with it, regardless if it was like kind of meandering, I would say.
I mean, I don't mind the slow drip of information, and I don't even mind hiding important parts of the plot or important details that are going to be big reveals later. I just felt like the show didn't really do enough to justify what it was doing in those sort of intermediate episodes when it felt like it was just trying to hide the ball in that. Like I feel like those are the kinds of episodes where you do more to establish your characters and tell individual stories, which honestly I feel like is something that season two has on season one. It felt like more of season two were these kind of standalone episodes that didn't really move the ball forward in terms of the plot, but gave you deeper dives into individual characters and what their journeys were. And I wish we'd kind of gotten to see more of that in the earlier episodes of season one.
Yeah, I think that assessment is I agree. I think largely with it that I feel like this season two, and it's a kind of, I feel like season two is frustrating to me in that way, because I can see
the art in those individual episodes, the ones that are more tightly focused on a single character or a single group of characters that, you know, we see multiple kind of, you know, like cliques of characters as they move through Westworld and try and achieve their individual goals. And you can, like, certain episodes are definitely, wow, this is very, doesn't really advance the overarching plot very much. Like, I think that's probably of everything my main complaint about season two is that it doesn't push, like, at the end of the day, it gets us to exactly where, like, it doesn't go any further. I was hoping that, I don't know, I assumed at the end of season one, I assumed that in season two, they would get out.
Mm-hmm.
Some hosts would get out of Westworld, and that would be a greater plot line heading forward, is robots versus humans. And it, you know, like, it has been that kind of, we've had, like, it's been underlying even before the hosts started rebelling. And I thought they would push the plot a little bit further than they got. They didn't, but you do get those deep dives. You do get those individual, the one in particular is what, Kixia? I don't know if that's, I'm saying that right.
Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce that.
But the one following Akecheta.
Akecheta?
I'm trying.
Akecheta. I'm not good at this either.
Akecheta. Like, the native host and the Ghost Nation, like, that is, like, because I like the empty philosophizing at times. I liked the back and forth between the AI, what AI is and what intelligence is and what choice is. Like, I like that stuff, I think, more than most people do, because, and, like, that's kind of why I really, really like season one, in that even when it was kind of just spending time of Anthony Hopkins just, like, talking to Bernard about the choice, evil, good, like, I still enjoyed it. And
Ford's philosophy corner.
Yeah, Ford's philosophy corner. I think it also is helpful. I think Anthony Hopkins, I might have said this in the first season podcast, but if you have exposition, make sure you hire Anthony Hopkins as the person to deliver it. It helps a lot, because he could read the back of a cereal box and make it sound very fascinating and interesting and make it nuanced.
He is very good at making nonsense sound profound.
Exactly. Which is, I mean,
it's an important skill for this show.
Yeah, exactly. It's very useful for this show in particular, because there's definitely a lot of nonsense. So end of season two, how are your feelings?
So my overall feelings on season two are, I think its highs were much higher than season one, but its lows were much lower. I felt like you had three episodes in the form of Reunion, the one where you trace essentially the path to Delos and William purchasing Westworld. I apologize for butchering this pronunciation as well. The Akane no Mai, the episode where they go to Shogun Land and meet Maeve and her crew, sort of meet their Japanese equivalents. And then last but not least, Kixuya. You know, those are the three most standalone episodes in the show so far, I think. And each was very well done. Each tells a self-contained story. Each deepens your understanding of the characters. Each touches on the themes that I think make Westworld interesting and still make it rich and fascinating, even when it's not necessarily firing on all cylinders. But at the same time, the overall arc of season two is not one that I found super compelling. It's a little ungainly. It's a little hodgepodge. And I thought the finale was a big bundle of nothing. I mean, I don't want to overstate that. I think there were cool things in it, some involving the characters at the center of that. But it felt like the show, A, running in place to some degree, but B, taking a dive directly up its own behind. And I left a bit of a sour taste in my mouth for what I thought was a season that can boast you know, it's only 20 episodes, but the three best episodes of the show so far.
Yeah, I don't. I think I'm lower on season two than I am season one. I'm still interested, and I'm still super excited to see more of this. I think I'm kind of a sucker, I think, for a lot of the things that are going on in the show in general, like the themes and the levels of meta narrative at times. There's less of it in season two because they're not really concerned about people, the stories. The stories are not the focus, which I think might hurt my feelings about the season in general, because season one had that we saw the uprising as it was happening. We saw the failures of the hosts as, you know, little by little, different hosts at different times are starting to realize, oh, we're in a story. We are reliving these things over and over and over again. And I felt that was very powerful and very interesting and allow. And like, I'm a sucker. For any kind of meta narrative in general, like, I just find it. And the problem is, like you said, it's a precarious place because you go too far and you are up your own butt. As you say, it is dangerous. And you're not the first person I heard say that this season does that. And I think, I don't know if I want to say if it's doing that or not. I do think it does get, like, season one, for all its faults, I was never bored, ever. I was always really super engaged. I generally watch stuff on my second monitor on my computer, and I'll be doing mindless stuff on my first screen while the second screen is playing. And season one took me away. I had to watch. I had to focus on it because it demanded my attention.
Mm-hmm.
And this season, I found myself like sighing at certain points. I'm like, come on, let's just get, why are we doing this? Why is this happening? We don't need, this seems pointless. It seems empty. There are multiple scenes that I felt like, why is this even on the screen? I don't need to see this. I don't need to see another scene of Maeve and her cohorts walking through tunnels and doing battle. Like, it felt very much like any time that they were like, oh, we need to fill 5 minutes. Oh, a strike force shows up and there's a fight.
You definitely get the sense that the show, if not HBO, then somebody who's involved in the show, feels like there needs to be a certain action quota in this to make the casual fans excited and not think that it's all just, you know, people philosophizing to one another about the nature of the self. And it does feel like any moment when the show seems a little dull, or they're worried that people are not going to pay super close attention to the explorations of robo self-actualization, they decide they're going to throw in a firefight, or somebody is going to hold somebody else at gunpoint, because that's what action shows do.
Yeah, and I find the action, like, there are certainly action scenes in both season one and two that I found really neat and are really effective. In season two in particular, the one that stands out to me, I don't even remember which episode it is. It's relatively early. It's when William is in the town where, I'm trying to remember everyone's name.
Pariah.
With Lawrence's families.
Pariah.
Okay. I don't, there's a million characters in this thing, and there's more in season two than there is season one, and trying to keep all this stuff straight is very difficult, but he's in.
I'm Andrew.
I know that. I got that straight, at least.
Cool.
I've typed your name a lot. when William is, it feels, and that feels like it is very similar in season one to like a straight up Western standoff, when William finally, he's, you know, after he's kind of half sold out the town and he's drinking with the Confederati, whatever it is.
Confederato.
Yeah. That actor, I've seen that actor so many times that I can never remember. I don't remember his actual name, but, the dude who plays the lead. There.
I know who you're talking about, but I don't remember either the character's name or the actor's name.
Yeah, it is Jonathan Tucker is the actor's name playing Major Craddock. But that scene in particular stands out to me, in that scene where, because then William, you know, shoots a bunch of these dudes and then literally makes the dude drink nitro, and then Lawrence shoots him and he explodes. And it's just there is an absurd level of violence at times.
Oh my, yes.
In this season. And that is one of the, and the other time is the is in the Shogun World episode with the,
I was gonna say, they do their own little pretty damn good samurai movie.
Yeah, that the other, that the counterpart, the Japanese Maeve
Akane.
Yeah.
That's her name.
Her sawing the dude's head off, basically. It's those, it's like those moments of where they, you get used to kind of the regular, like, blood packs exploding off of people as they get shot, which it's probably mostly CGI, honestly. But it's those moments where you're like, oh, right, this is absurdly violent. And, like, it makes, it accentuates the themes of the show. And I think it's best when that happens, and it makes those people look awesome and badass, which I appreciate, even when it's maybe sometimes is, doesn't belong in the show at times, and they still try and do it. But
it's also, it fits because it's what a certain segment of the audience wants. And you can also imagine that it's what a decent number of people who come to the park want. That it's inspired by those spaghetti westerns and samurai movies that often had pretty ridiculous amounts of violence, or at least that's sort of what the place they hold in the popular consciousness is. And so it kind of works, again, on multiple levels of what the guests would be seeking if they came to a place like this, and also what a certain, bloodthirsty is the wrong word, but action-loving audience expects from Westworld at the same time.
Yeah, Peck and Paul Westerns. Those there are, you go. Yeah, wild bunch, all them. I just don't, I don't need, you know, military contractor dudes, whatever they are, black op guys, wet works dude with guns, with, you know, super advanced machine guns, shooting. Like, I got my fill. I don't need any more of it. By, like, season, like, episode 7, 8, I'm like, oh, more of these nameless dudes that I know are going to get killed. I don't recognize any of them. They're going to die. They're all red shirts. And I know what's happening. And
it gets tiresome after a while.
It's that, and the tunnel, like the up and down, the Maeve storyline bums me out in season 2.
Really? Because I mean, maybe I'm just overrating it because of how good I thought the interlude in Shogun Land is, but I thought a lot of it was pretty damn good.
I think the Shogun World stuff is fun because it is novel, because we haven't seen what Shogun World is like, and it's a dip into, like, oh, it's more of the meta narrative going on, because all the characters are similar archetypes, and, you know, some of them hate each other and some of them love each other. It's very interesting that way. And then there's this, the same, like, the struggle of these similar characters and seeing how their choices differ, despite the fact that they're basically the same person. That's interesting to me, but it's not that, like, I love Maeve, and I thought Maeve was awesome in season 1, and she's still pretty cool in season 2 a lot of the time. It just felt her story felt more like her and Dolores, to be fair, like, both of them, they have all these different stops along the way of trying to get to the land beyond, the valley beyond,
glory.
Yeah, the glory. And they're doing all these different things. And it makes me realize, like, oh, no, none of this is all empty. I don't, like, what does Dolores' experience with, like, aside from Teddy being unable to execute that one dude, what they're like, I can't remember anything substantial happening when they're with the Confederados.
She meets her father for the first time since he has had his brain wiped and replaced and everything, and you have what I thought was a pretty touching scene between the two of them where she laments that this is the state that he's in, and he remembers her despite this sort of madness that has overtaken him. You know, like, I didn't think the firefight itself with the Confederados was all that important or all that interesting, but I think if there's one thing that I liked about season 2 relative to season 1, is that season 1 had to spend a lot of time hiding who these people really were. It had to make you guess as to what was going on with Bernard. It wanted to leave hints as to what was happening with Dolores, but not necessarily seal that she was having this awakening. It had to make William cool and the Man in Black cool, or at least interesting, without connecting the two of them. And it sort of had to develop what was going on with Maeve. And at the same time, it didn't want to get too deep into those things because that was a curtain to be pulled back and get the audience to go, whoa, I had no idea that was coming. Whereas here, you know who these characters are. You know what they want. You know what they're after. And that allows you to explore them in different ways when you're kind of waiting for the fireworks to go off. I liked that about season two. I like that you get those scenes between Dolores and her father, or between Dolores and Teddy, where you learn more about who Dolores is now, even if it doesn't necessarily get you any closer to the end game of the season or the show.
This is, I think, a general feeling I have about both Dolores and Maeve. And I'm just not sure how much of it's intentional or not.
Mm-hmm.
About both of their connections, Dolores spends a large part of the season trying to get her father back. And I think prior to even that, what she knows is inside of his head. Like, she just wants her dad, her robot dad back.
Mm-hmm.
And Maeve's whole thing is, the reason she didn't leave Westworld in the first place is because she wants her daughter. And I find it weird that both of these hosts who are, they are the wokest of the hosts, I would say.
I like that description.
Those two are the wokest of the two, all the hosts. And like, most of them are conscious and aware of what they are and to varying levels of degrees about what's happening up below them, technically.
Mm-hmm.
But it feels like those two know exactly what's happening. Maeve and Dolores both are as aware of what's happening in Westworld as any human. And they know what they are. They know that they've had layers of personality built into them over and over and over and over and over again, and things erased and replaced and changed. And I understand it very. I think I understand it more in Maeve's part because she kind of. I think she even consciously recognizes the fact that her attachment to this child host is not necessarily rational or logical.
I agree. I think she says as much in season one, if I'm not mistaken. She's trying to resist that urge and saying that it doesn't matter, but can't fight it anyway.
Right. And so that it bothers me less in that case. But in Dolores, I'm kind of – because Dolores is the coldest, most dead-hearted monster. Like, her and William, and they say as much, are like two of a kind in this season. She's just mowing
– I learned it from watching you.
Exactly. Just mowing down everybody. And yet – She knows that he's not her real father. She knows that she was made in a lab. She's older than him. She's existed long before he did. And yet she still chases him, goes after him. And I feel like I don't know if that's on purpose or not. Like, if they're trying to point her at, oh no, she still has these weird attachments that she can't explain, but she's still going to chase them. But
I mean, she's still attached to Teddy, despite knowing that that is arbitrary. And even when she turns him into the Terminator or what have you, she sort of gives him a last meal. Like, she kind of has this last experience with Teddy as he was, because that's still valuable to her. And I have a lot of problems with season two, but I actually liked the exploration they did with Maeve and with Dolores for what these attachments mean to them, even though that they know that it's not real in the sense that, you know, this guy actually is Dolores' father, or that this young woman is actually Maeve's daughter. They know that that's an implanted memory and an attachment that they did not choose or that was crafted for them. But the feeling exists, and they are hard-pressed to resist it. And I think the difference, the fact that Maeve holds on to that attachment, is supposed to be the thing that keeps her human in a season that is very much about Dolores losing her humanity or moving past it, however you want to think about it. That Maeve, even when she has this unimaginable power, even when she has every reason and also the ability to escape, she goes back because this is something she cannot dig out of her brain, no matter how much she wants to. And by contrast, Dolores says her goodbye, but tears into her father's skull in order to get the key to decrypt the forge or whatever it is. And when they run into each other, she says to Maeve, you know, family is just another lash that they use to hold us down. She has moved past it. She has severed this connection and severed it for good. And it is, to me at least, symbolic of how Dolores is severing, slowly but surely severing, her ties to her humanity, to the things that make her able to understand what human beings are and why they're valuable. And Maeve is still holding on to them, both in the form of her attachment to her daughter and that she sees value in folks like Sizemore or Lutz, the tech who has helped her out. You know, you have these two woke hosts who are on very different trajectories. And I found the contrast between them and the very brief moments we get to see them interact as pretty powerful for that reason.
I also feel like Maeve and Dolores in particular are not as I think all the acting in this is very good. I cannot point to any one person and say they did a bad job.
Nobody dramatic.
Okay. Well, I would say both Tandy Newton and Evan Rachel Wood do a tremendous job as both as Dolores and Maeve.
Agreed.
I think they're given not as good material in season two as season one. I think they pull as much as they possibly can out of it. And I feel like the writing is not like it's strange to me because there are several characters basic like the whole Chataway episode, the Kixia episode, is like a character piece. It's like a character study of him. And it's done very well, but I feel like Maeve and Dolores are often saddled with lines that are just, this is how I feel. I say exactly what
that's
it...
everybody though. That's not them. That's everybody in the whole show. Like, well, there's a scene in the finale or something where, you know, William says something effective like, well, then I guess our interests are aligned until they're not. And I say to myself, like, you can't just have your characters announce how they feel. That makes me angry. Every character in this show outright states what their motivation is. Sometimes you have the conceit that it's a host saying, this is my cornerstone, and it's part of some analysis or something. But everybody in this show is just like, here is how I feel, and here is what I hope to gain from these interactions.
I don't think it's that bad. I don't know when to say every character does that.
I mean, every important character, except for Ford, who is never straightforward about anything. That guy would go into a coffee shop and say, I want a liquid flowing from the bean in a vessel of my own design.
Well, I miss it. A version of Ford shows up in this season, and I don't, whatever it is, I don't like it as much. I liked Ford in season one. I liked his purposefully annoying at times of refusal to state anything in just straightforward manner. He's constantly speaking in metaphor or often empty metaphor. Even
I was gonna say I like Hopkins too, but let's call it what it is.
I appreciated him a lot in season one, and I think he's very good at delivering bad exposition.
Agreed.
Which I think some of the people who had to take up in his stead aren't nearly as good at it as Anthony Hopkins is, which I don't think there's probably very few people on Earth who are as good at it as Anthony Hopkins is.
I was going to say, it's no shame. It's no shame not to be as good at acting as Anthony Hopkins.
No, it's not. I think it's not just them. It's just the show in general. It feels like it's spinning its wheels at times, and I think that's my main frustration. I think you touch upon this at once where you can only see so much brutality. I don't know if you, maybe I don't remember. I've read too much things about Westworld today. Someone, either you
don't know, you're having memories stacked upon memories.
God. Violence like meets violence.
Additional Shakespeare quote number four.
Yeah, another Shakespeare. I can only see so many people just get shot in the head before it doesn't mean anything anymore. And
especially when they keep coming back from the dead.
Yeah, that's true as well. I will give them that by erasing by destroying the backups, the deaths of the hosts actually are somewhat meaningful.
But for now, I mean, until they find the backup to the backup.
It
was all in the cloud already, Ford had his secret stash.
Is that fair? Is that fair to... I mean, it's only been two seasons. It's not been like five of this.
No, but I guess two seasons in, I have reached the point where I refuse to believe that anybody is permanently dead. There's just been too many people who turn out to either come back from the dead, whether it's Elsie turning out to have been just chained up in a cave, or Ford continuing to live in the cradle, or Dolores being put into a host that looks like Hale. You can only have characters cheat death so many times before you lead me to assume that they will continue to cheat death. That's just the state of play. And I don't have a problem with that necessarily. Like, if that is the tone and the setup that Westworld wants to go for, I think you can do meaningful stuff with that. Obviously, you know, Robbie, you can speak to the fact that death is not necessarily a very permanent thing in comic books and comic book stories.
What?
But that does, you know, keep those stories from being meaningful, that you can still tell really meaningful stories within that framework. I just am not very convinced that anybody who is popular enough, we're not going to find their secret clone or, you know, host, or that they're going to have been downloaded into somebody's iPhone before kicking the bucket.
It's not an iPhone, all right? It's a little piece of metal that's the shape of a credit card. Or a marble.
I guess that wasn't that long ago.
A marble that you hold in your pocket and then you put it in their brain and it is them all again.
And Dolores has a bag full of them.
She does. I wonder who they are. Could be anyone.
I imagine they'll tell us immediately in season 3, episode 1, and not spin that out for at least a few more episodes.
I think season 1 will get the end of the first episode of season 3. We'll get the first reveal of who's in that bag, probably. I have a feeling.
Turns out it's Yul Brynner.
I'd be down with that. I don't know. It'd probably be a weird CGI Yul Brynner. So it's probably if they give it enough budget, it'd probably be fine.
People had some pretty negative reactions to Grand Moff Tarkin showing up in Rogue One. So I don't know.
Yeah, I bet they'd
how people would feel about the digital resurrection, but
probably be upset again. Speaking of, what was it? The Cradle. How now we have the Matrix. Matrix is hanging out in here too. We got another layer.
I like the Cradle. I like the Forge, to be honest, as concepts that you see Ford as somebody who thinks human thinking is very limited in its way, and that there is, you know, even if people can't be put in flesh and blood bodies, there is a way for people to live on, and particularly for his creations to live on in a sort of afterlife or paradise. I like, if nothing else, the metaphorical implications for those locations. I said in my write-up for the Akachita episode that I really like how that episode frames the basic premise of Westworld as a spiritual journey, that the process of self-actualization and discovering that there is a deeper world is something you can read literally as Akachita discovering that there's all this infrastructure around the park, but you can also read it metaphorically as, you know, somebody having the sense that something is amiss in the world and seeking enlightenment or seeking a deeper, higher plane of understanding. And I like the forge as a literalization of that. It's something to continue that metaphor, especially with regards as a sort of closing beat for Akechete in this episode.
I only bring it up because as soon as they showed, as soon as Bernard went into the cradle for the first time, and we see Ford there, and it's really him, or it is a version of him at least. It is his brain, his mind up on a computer. I immediately went, oh no, they need to be careful with this. Because I give them credit in that they didn't do the contrived awful thing of some certain thing. They forecasted, they foreshadowed pretty clearly when and when people were there and when they were not, and they made it clear, okay, this is when this is actually happening. This is the real world, not the cradle. This is not the Matrix.
Yeah, they show everything in letterbox when they're in the cradle. So it's not like the time skipping around that they do otherwise, where you kind of have to squint and double check as to when things are. Like, it's, they make it pretty darn clear visually when you're in the digital world.
Right. And that I was just worried as soon as I saw that happen. I'm like, are they gonna try and mess with me? Because after season one and the reveals and the way that the show and like the it feels very much like, all right, we're battle of wits here, and I don't, you know, I want it to feel earned. I want the reveals to feel like, you know, if they're going to be revealing mysteries to me, that mystery box, I'd want it to be at least a fair one. And if they're starting to show me certain things are happening in the real world and certain ones aren't, and then you don't know that until the last episode or something, I'm going to get upset. This is not 1999 anymore. You can't do, you ever see The 13th Floor?
I have not.
It came out the exact same time as The Matrix. It has a very similar idea. It got very overshadowed, but it's a pretty solid movie. But it also, it's a noir movie with, you know, virtual stuff, virtual places going on. But it pulls that kind of trick. And I immediately went, they better not do that trick, because I'm going to be upset if they do. They don't. But
it's a show that pulls off those kinds of tricks, so you're not in any way unwarranted in your anxiety about it.
Speaking of tricks, you mentioned the time thing, which they do again, a different degree than in prior season one, you know, was the whole William Man in Black. Both stories are the same person at different times. And they don't, it's not William this time primarily, it's mostly Bernard. Bernard is our multiple timeline man. He's usually the one present when we're at different times and we're not exactly sure when it is. I felt like the season one, William is the Man in Black, the split timeline thing, I thought that was very effective. I liked that. I liked the dichotomy of the two. I liked it was hammy at times, like a lot of things in the show, but I still liked it. It's a very simple and effective tool. I'm not as confident in my feelings about the things they do with Bernard in this season, and primarily in the way they're trying to use the same kind of, he's living all his memories all at once, and you know on top of that, he's also seeing imaginary people.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I mean, I think if there is anybody in the show who is fairly well served by season one and pretty poorly served by season two, it's got to be Bernard, because, you know, he is in, I'm not going to say in control, but he has a pretty clear journey through season one. And here he is mostly a passenger as to what's going on, not to get, you know, too deep into the buzzwords that the show itself is using. He doesn't direct a lot of the action. A lot of the action happens to him. He, as you point out, with Ford gone, is often the one responsible for delivering some of that clunky exposition and trying to make it work. And they don't, you know, there's times when it's clear, but there's a lot of times when it's not in any way signaled to the audience when these actions from Bernard, when these events that Bernard is involved in are supposed to be taking place and how we're supposed to process them in conjunction with one another. I definitely think He is, in my opinion, the character who suffers the most between season one and season two.
Like, it's a strange thing to me because I think Bernard, the character, doesn't get to do a bunch of interesting things, but I find myself most engaged with him around because it is actually very plot heavy stuff happening with the park and with the encryption key. And like, he is the vehicle to a lot of mysteries being revealed to us, you know, about the park and about the fact that they're, you know, creating copies of people, you know, of people's identities basically. And for use, how do they sell that? Like that's the other thing that is always lurking there and they never address it. Like they use IP, I think, 10,000 times. I believe we have to that's one third of our IP just gone, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They have all this IP that they so want to remind us about. That's what the whole encryption key is. That's why Hale is there to recover it and send it back. That's the most valuable thing. How do they monetize these copies of people?
I mean, maybe I'm naive, but I imagined you sell it to rich people to say, we're going to make you immortal. We can preserve you after death. And if you give us $5 million, we'll use that technology and allow you to do that.
But I mean...
Though I guess so I'm not sure if they have actually made that deal with people. It seems like the implication is that their copying of individuals is surreptitious at this point. And maybe that's until they perfect the technology. But the idea of IP that would allow you to preserve somebody's brain in the digital world, that would be pretty damn valuable, I would think.
I know, but it's not like I understand the technology is, yes, it's extraordinarily valuable, but it's just the copies of the people. It's just the data. And I don't know. Every time, in the latter half of the season, after you find out exactly what's going on with what that data is, I'm still going, but wait, what are they going to do with the data to make money? I understand how they utilize the technology because, yes, the, you know, turning people into digital immortal copies of themselves, of course, a lot of people would definitely not want to. Would want to be immortal. I think that's the first. Yeah, rich people, you could sell it for. You can name your price. Name your price.
I think a lot of when they say the IP, they also mean the software that makes it possible for them to, you know, preserve and adjust and do what they need to do to make that a reality. Like I don't know if you know 10,000 artificial copies of people's brains are necessarily worth that much, though. You have to imagine there's some kind of market for that somewhere. Maybe you, some call center buys them and turns them into customer service representatives or something. But I think you can also read it as like when they refer to the IP, they're referring to the brains as their proof of concept, but also the software and the code that allows them to, you know, take in those brains and process them as ones and zeros in meaningful ways.
4 million minds, actually.
4 million. That is a lot.
Well, every single person's gone through the park.
You would need a lot of zip drives for that.
It's 4 million cowboy hats.
so that was honestly what I thought was the dumbest thing in the entire season. Like, this is a show where science is basically magic. Why do we need to know that people wear cowboy hats to scan their brains? Why couldn't it just be some, like, you're on the train and it scans you when you're on your way in and on your way out, or, you know, they have hover bots or something. God only knows. Why do you need cowboy hats? Why? This was a question of world building that nobody needed an answer to.
I mean,
what do they do in Shogun Land? What do they do in Raj Land?
It'd be the other hats. Everyone wears a hat. You have to wear a hat in Westworld.
Do they? Sizemore didn't wear a hat in Shogun Land, and neither did Maeve.
Well, that's
Maeve's a host, so she doesn't count.
Yeah, and Sizemore was going in as against his will. You know, he's not a guest, really. You know, he's not a paying guest. He's an employee. I mean,
I guess they had safari hats in Rosland. I'm trying to remember.
If I don't know. Everyone wears a hat. That is true. It's not. I think
your mission is to walk around the Westworld planet and not wear a helmet.
The fact that I don't know. I think it's one. If they didn't ask the question, people would go. Fans would go. How they would ask the question.
But how anything in this damn show? Like, I don't know.
I don't know. They go to pretty good lengths to explain a lot of things that probably don't need explaining. They refuse to answer a lot of very important questions that I definitely want to know the answers to, and then also answer many questions that I don't necessarily need. I think it would be best left to our imagination. I don't mind the cowboy hat thing. I think it's hammy and dumb. But I kind of like it anyway, because the whole, like, you go back to William in season one and they ask him to pick a hat, and it's like a very clear representation of, oh, he's good, white hat, black hat, good guy, bad guy, all that. But
I mean, it's the least of the show's problems. It's no. Just a little stupid nitpick thing.
Oh, it is. Me. Oh, it's very, I mean, if let me think of the things I find most. I don't know if I have a particular one thing that I thought was the dumbest thing. I don't know, probably the backfire on William's gun
blowing. Yeah, that was pointless.
That was very bad. I don't know why his hand had to be exploded. He gets... So, okay, William. Let's talk about William. I think William gets some much... I like a lot of the backstory. You pointed out the journey of him with Delos. Like, that episode's great, of their history together and him selling the park to him, basically selling the idea of the park to Delos, and then of us discovering what that version of Delos is in that little room where he dances. That episode in particular, and there's this season in general, but that episode in particular, and I think the comparison in general is probably pretty apt, is because of the, you know, mystery box thing. But that episode in particular reminded me so much of Lost. The musical cues and the repetition of the flashbacks to, you know, of clear and of delineated flashbacks of, like, yeah, this is clearly the past. Now we're in the present. We're going to tell this story actually pretty clearly. It reminded me, the music in general, like, that reminded me so much of Lost with the because they pulled that trick as well. I think it's very effective when you have those easy musical cues of popular music and this rich guy dancing.
It's certainly a fun and striking image, that is for sure. Though Lost is one of my great TV blind spots, so I'll take your word for it.
Watch season one, and then you can stop.
It went for like 6 or 7 seasons,
it
right?
It did. You're right. It did go for 6. So you can watch season one. I think you'll be very... And then just don't worry about any of those questions that are left open. I think season one is like a perfect season of television, and then everything after that is downhill. Or various levels of worse. It never gets as good as season one again. There's some people would argue that the later seasons kind of get better again. Season 2 and 3 are a rough. I will say that season 2 of this show does much better job than season 2 of Lost does.
Well, that's reassuring.
Yeah. I mean, it's also 10 episodes. I think that helps. It's relatively brief. Lost was full season, 20 plus episodes. William gets, you know, we in season one, we saw William as, you know, we saw him as the young man, you know, falling in love with Dolores. And then we see him as the man in black, as a dyed-in-the-wool killer chasing a mystery that was not meant for him. In this episode, he was very intriguing, but calling him a full-on character I would say it's a little generous just after season one, because he is two different things, and we kind of have to fill in the gap of how he got from one to the other.
Yeah, they do kind of a 5-minute montage that's supposed to show how the upstanding, decent guy that we meet in the Jimmy Simpson guys turns into the cruel and heartless Ed Harris character. And there's not a lot of connective tissue there beyond some exposition.
Right. And this season does a lot of like showing him, oh, he has a, of showing his relationship with his daughter, with his late wife, him developing his, how much he's invested in the park and why he's so invested in the park, beyond just kind of pathological personality issues. Also, like the whole, you know, he is the reason that they are chasing this, the immortality of putting actual people's minds into hosts in the end game.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to ask you, this is how I felt. I don't know if we're supposed to hate him, right? He's supposed to be the worst guy, right?
Yeah, I think so. You also get the sense that he is grieving, that he kind of had a psychotic break, or at least had a very difficult time after the death of his wife, and he isn't all there anymore. He questions repeatedly whether or not the people he's communicating with are actually real, or whether they're hosts that Ford has sent to confuse him. He's supposed to be cast, I think, from the very beginning. You get scenes of this with William, or, you know, the Jimmy Simpson young William pretty early. He's somebody who lived in his stories. And I think he's reached the point where he no longer can distinguish between real life and stories. And you're still supposed to hate him, but you're also supposed to understand him. It's hard to hate what you understand.
Because I don't hate him. He does some very... The there are some confusing choices they made with William in late in the season.
Yeah,
but I don't ever hate him. Like it makes like it feels straight. Like I end up just pitying him for the most part. I never hate him. I don't like they find like the first season paints him as this cold blooded monster, but he's engaged. Like a lot, I can't necessarily blame any of the people that engage with these hosts as if they're not real, because that's what they're told. They're told when they come into this park, oh yeah, these are robots. They don't have feelings. They're programmed to act this way. They don't, nothing you do matters. You can do whatever you want to them. It's fine. They're not real people. And
yeah, I mean, we see the light in their eyes. And so it has a resonance when they're shot to bits or assaulted or that kind of thing. But and my wife pointed out that if you're playing a video game and beat up some bystanders in it, people might look at you sideways, but nobody would think you were an immoral person for doing that.
And so when William does those things, I don't go, oh, he's a monster. I go, oh, he's playing a game. And like, I might disagree with, like, in general with the things he's did, but it, you know, and then they...
So if somebody was torturing people in a video game, you might still look...
Yeah, that's a different thing altogether. But he's largely engaging with, I mean, they don't ever show him doing something that's impossibly depraved. Like the worst thing he does is kind of
he sexually assaults Dolores, or at least that's the implication early on.
Do we actually see that though? Because I'm not.
Yeah, we don't see it, but it's pretty heavily implied when he's dragging her over to the hay shed. And
I thought he gets stopped.
Well, no, that's the impetus, because she shoots a different guy because she's having flashbacks of old, or, you know, Man in Black William doing it to her.
I've not watched season one since it ended, so I'll bow to your prescience knowledge, the knowledge of having watched it very recently. I only have vague recollections of very specific things in season one.
He also scalps that guy.
He does. Again, there. It's.
He
I just
flips
don't.
That guy upside down and drains out all his blood so we can put it in Teddy.
He does do that, which. Oh my god. I forgot about that altogether.
That's how science works.
That's how blood works. You just got to take it from one person and put it in another, and you'll be fine. I end of the day, like, I feel like we're supposed to just despise him, And I just go, he seems impossibly hurt and not still alive at the end of the season two. He's been
shot.
Yeah,
the guy should have died like 5 times.
Yeah, he got hurt really bad at the end of season one. And he's fine when they come back to, like, all he does is like patch up a arm wound and he's okay.
He has the magic laser pointer, so he's good now.
Oh, is that what it does it?
He like busts into that saloon and finds the little laser pointer thing and uses it on his shoulder, so he's totally good.
Okay, good. That's my worries are eased about the nature of him. Just like if Dolores gets shot 4 times and is fine, I totally can buy it.
Yeah, she's a robot.
She's a robot. Although that's the other thing they never actually answer is like what does it require for them to die? Because sometimes
that's a good question.
Sometimes they
presumably
just get,
as long as their little marble is intact, they're fine.
But sometimes they get shot in the shoulder and they just fall over down. And then other times Dolores gets shot 6 times and she just like bloop, terminators it and just keeps going. And I don't. It's those. I don't know. Maybe answer that question. Maybe have one scene with the two lab nerds talking over a dead body of a robot and saying, oh, this is why he died. That bullet went right there. He's done.
Or you have Sizemore or somebody say, like, oh, yes, when it's included in the story, they fall down at a moment's notice. But if they're not programmed to, they can withstand incredible punishment.
That's a very good Sizemore impersonation there.
Well, thank you, Robbie. Good
impression. There you go. Simon Quarterman. Who does a great job in this? He gets a lot. He gets more in season two, I think, and I appreciate.
Yeah,
it.
Yeah, I was going to say he was somebody who I hated as a character in season one. And frankly, pretty much anybody on the office building side of Westworld in season one, I had very little interest in him in particular. But he is very well served in this. He went from one of my least favorite characters to one of my favorite characters.
Yeah, he has a good. He gets stuff to do, I think, more than just be drunk and complain about having to write things. He still does that. He still does that some, but he also actually, you know, his relationship with Maeve is kind of fascinating. And
yeah, he kind of does director's commentary as they're going through Westworld, which is a really interesting thing.
William, what is going on with William and his daughter? And what has happened?
God only knows.
I was really invested when she showed up for the first time. I was really like, oh, neat. She hunted him down. Like, she came here and she'd done the research. But we're supposed to think that he really killed his daughter, right? That was the real one.
Yes, that is the implication. Though she... He's when he's like, let me prove it to you, and she has the little, never mind, pardon me. When the Strike Force shows up and they're using their little price check scanners to test whether or not William and Emily are actually hosts or not, you see the results, but of William, I think, or they scan him and he's fine, but you never see the results for Emily. So he at least believes eventually that it's the real her. I mean, maybe that's the implication they want to leave you with, but okay. They intentionally obscure it as to whether or not she is actually the real Emily.
And
which makes me think it's not.
Yeah, I hope it's not, because that feels like such a waste.
Well, it was such a stupid thing to do. Like, even I wrote this in my little review that, like, even if you think there is a 0.00001% chance that this woman is actually your daughter, there's a lot of steps you can take without killing her if you're skeptical, you know? Like, it's a pretty extreme choice. Now, I guess the man in black is a man of extreme choices, but I
like,
it is wasted opportunities.
It's not that I don't necessarily buy him doing a very stupid thing, and especially in that situation where, one, he's basically lived in Westworld for years, it seems. Like, he seems like this is where he spends, like, most of his time. He only leaves when he absolutely has to, for business reasons. And that the kind of Westworld that he, I guess, inhabits is full of itchy trigger figures and you know, short tempers, and people will attack him very quickly, and he's used to, you know, shoot first, ask questions later.
Mm-hmm.
And she does put her hand behind her back, and she, and I did notice, like, it is a very clear, I think this is them trying to make it a little bit more appetizing, is the fact that she takes his gun, tucks it into her ammo belt behind her back, and then they show her, they show the gun tucked in behind her back as she's talking to him while he's, you know, hurt at the tree. And I assume that, like, yeah, he would think, oh, she's going for her gun, because Ford has programmed her to do that or whatever. You know, it's all, and it, so, like, yeah, it's dumb, but I can maybe get, but it feels like there's just so much left there. Like, she's there. She's there for, like, what, 2 or 3 episodes, and then she's dead. And I'm like, what? Look, come on. Like, we don't even know if she's really her. We don't even know why she was actually there. She says she wants the truth. Like, does she want to know if her dad ended up, you know, driving her mother to suicide? Is that what she actually? That's the only answer she wants. She came to Westworld for that. I think it's safe to assume yes.
It's a pretty big question that could gnaw at somebody.
I mean, she see that, but that's like, so it's either like, I think we're led to believe that it is either she wants to know for sure that he's at fault, or two, just to punish him, like, just, and like, that's what she says to why can't I ever remember characters' names? Yes, dear God. That's what she even says to him. She says, "My way will hurt more."
Yeah, and she has that really good scene between the two of them where she says, "You can't just come out here and do suicide by robot or whatever it is." She wants him to process these things the same way that she is. If nothing else, she has questions that she wants answered, and she doesn't want him to die out there before she can get her answers. And William is not necessarily somebody who is forthcoming with those things. He's learned a lot from Ford in his time in Westworld.
And that's the thing. Like, if that's the answer, if that by saying, oh, yeah, my way is going to hurt him more, meaning I want him to actually process his wife's death and behave like a real human being. Like, oh, that's a great answer. That's the most, that's a great reason for her to go. I mean,
that could be
this.
Me projecting and filling in gaps here.
No, I mean,
For all I know, she's going to show up again next season and be like, the real reason was because I had to get the super secret double IP that's beneath the original layer of IP.
I really hope. If they do that again, I might. That might be the bridge too far for me. But that's a great reason. Why would she act the way she acted at all? Why would she try? Why would she? I don't. Like, she's. Seems like everyone is so cagey about why they're, like, you say, oh, they always state exactly how they feel, but she's just like, oh, I want to know this is how I feel about my mother's death, but she can't just say, hey, dad, you know, she can't just tell him, hey, you know, you never really processed your mom's death, and this is very dangerous. Maybe we can go have coffee after we escape the robot apocalypse.
Okay, I will revise my earlier statement. I would say that for 90% of the show, the characters have one of two settings. Either openly declarative about their intentions or needlessly cryptic about them.
Yes, needlessly cryptic. I should just call Westworld Season 3. It should just be Westworld needlessly cryptic.
I guess I'm sounding very negative. I liked a lot of this show, and I thought it did a lot of really good things. And I think it has great performers who, even when the material isn't necessarily stellar, they can elevate it into something greater. And I feel like, you know, whether you're talking about William's story or you're talking about Maeve's story, or you're talking about Dolores's story, it is impeccably crafted and is production design. It is impeccably acted for the most part. I think there's some weak spots, but for the most part, the performers are great. And for the most part, the themes are really, really interesting in every layer. But some of the writing, both in terms of the plot and the dialogue, is it's a lot, and it's pretty uneven, and it becomes in places enough that it's hard for all those other great things about the show that keep me watching and keep me wanting to watch it. It's a lot for that to overcome.
I think it gets, like, you're right. I think, one, the show looks beautiful. Even it doesn't matter, like, how quickly or meandering a pace of an episode is, or if the writing is bad or whatever in any particular line, it continually looks amazing. The how everything's framed, how it's shot, the settings, they're always, it's, you know, from the simplest of camera tricks to just shots of people riding on desert dunes, it's always looks gorgeous. The soundtrack, still good. I don't know. I'm a sucker for those player piano covers of things. I could listen to 100 of them in a row. I would not get tired of just the weird player piano covers of Nirvana or whatever. I was like, yeah, just feed them up. I'll eat every single one. I don't care. Give me that garbage.
and then we get the Shogunland version of Painted Black to bring us full circle.
Again, I think I had this discussion with my wife in the car one day. I'm like, is there a song that has been covered more times than Painted Black? Which she, after looking some things on the internet, yes, of course, there have been.
Hallelujah?
Yesterday by the Beatles, apparently, is like the most, is covered more than anything. A lot of people also include like standards that have been covered, and that's a standard. That's not a cover. Anyone can sing a standard. That's the whole point of them. Which Hallelujah might, I don't know if I necessarily quite put it in that territory, but it's at this point it's getting there. But Painted Black, I'm a sucker for Painted Black, and any cover of Painted Black, honestly, the Japanese Painted Black cover. Now I've heard the Japanese version and the French version of Painted Black.
There's a French version?
There is a French cover. A French pop band, I think, covered Painted Black.
Huh.
It's very, right. It's good. It's in,
check that out.
Here, you know where I heard it for the first time?
Where's that?
Talladega Nights.
Okay. I've seen that movie, but it was a long time ago. I don't remember that cover.
I love Talladega Nights. It's one of my favorite comedies. I think it's the Southern in me coming out. but all those, like, I think I don't know if necessarily the writing is any worse than it was in season one. I think season two, this season they had a harder job. I think the difficulty of nailing, of answering those questions that they are left in at the end of season one, of picking up those narrative threads and stringing them along, there's less structure there. There's less stuff that they can hang on now. You know, season one, most of the season, the park is still functioning. So you can fill in a lot of it with just, look how the park works. You see how this park works? Let's explore that. If there's bad writing, let's just make fun of the writer. He's a dumb drunk.
That is an easy out.
They have him show up and be a dumb drunk. They make him a real character this time, which is nice, but you can't blame the bad writing on the fact, hey, they're robots, and this is like a weird stage play that they're kind of half participating in while the humans, you know, go chase whatever they want to in the park. You know, now these people are real characters. You know, you kind of alluded to that earlier. You know, they're not spending any time in this season like building up what and who Dolores is. You come into the season knowing she is a woken host. She is the Deathbringer, which quite a name, quite a nickname for Dolores. And
there are known quantities now.
Yes.
You don't have the carrot of figuring out what the real story is with them to try to bait the audience along.
Yes.
You have to make them worthwhile in their own right.
Right. And I think they do a lot of I think, frankly, it's the emotional beats between characters are always good. It's the plot that's stringing these people along from thing to thing is the thing I maybe sometimes fails them. Of why are they going here? Don't think about it too much. Why are they, like, maybe it's just because they don't tell us why they're going to the Valley Beyond for most of the season. these characters?
The answer is because the plot needs them to all be in the same place in the season finale.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it makes sense to have, like, oh, yes, this very valuable thing is in the Valley Beyond. Although, by the end, I was kind of... reveal that Dolores was Hale, or inside of Hale's body, did you see that coming at all?
I did not. I didn't see it coming one bit. Though, I also am not the biggest fan of Hale as a character, so I was not necessarily enthused or hoping that that would be a twist.
Why don't you like Hale?
Oh, she's just the same old generic evil corporateer that I feel like I've seen 100 times in 100 different movies and shows. Like, going as far back as Aliens, which I know, you know, 1980s is not that far back. But the Paul Reiser character, who is the smiling but secretly evil and anything for the corporation at any cost jerk, I'm so done with that archetype without something else, some wrinkle to make them more interesting than just that stock character.
Do you think about the same thing in season? Do you think of her the same way in season one?
Oh, yeah. I mean, frankly, pretty much everybody in the Westworld offices, I kind of felt that way about, whether it was her or Teresa or, again, Sizemore, I thought was just kind of the generic tortured artist and didn't have much to do. Like, I don't know. I need more from that kind of character to not just roll my eyes at the standard corporate bad guy blueprint being used.
Yeah, do you think it changes anything that she's a woman? That the character, you know, that same standard corporate coldness, but it's a young woman? A young woman of color, even?
I think it could, but I don't think the show does anything with that. It kind of did that a little bit with Teresa at first, but it doesn't really do any of that with Hale. And, like, the very fact that, I guess, the mere fact that she, you know, is a woman and is a person of color, it's interesting, and I'm glad to see that, but they don't use that in any meaningful way in the show. And it's not even subtext, I would argue. And so I think that could be something that could make it more interesting. It could be a wrinkle, but you could replace Hale with, you know, Paul Reiser, and I don't think the character would be meaningfully different.
I much prefer looking at Tessa Thompson than I do Paul Reiser.
Hey, don't malign the good looks of Paul Reiser, the down-to-earth good looks of Paul Reiser.
I think you're right. I don't think they do anything. I think there is some subtext with Tandy Newton as Maeve. I feel like there is something there with the fact that, you know, she's not only just a woman, she's a woman of color playing this prostitute host, you know, the madam.
No, there's tons of layers of meaning to having a African-American woman who is, for all intents and purposes, not only a slave, but one who is, you know, used for sex by the wealthy, mostly Caucasian attendees of this park. That is very palpable subtext that makes her journey into not only, you know, rising above, but taking over much more potent in a way that I don't think they'd do anywhere near as much, if anything at all, with Hale on that front.
Yeah. Maybe season three you'll get more interesting Hale. I think, well, she's not Hale anymore, technically. What is she? Like, you see her at the end, now that Dolores has swapped back, I guess. That's what I assume has happened at the end of season, in episode 10, is that, because we see Dolores in her body again. And then we also see Hale, and I don't know who's in Hale's body. Is it just the weird, is it a copy of Hale? That Dolores has tweaked, so to speak, like she did with Teddy.
I was going to say, my bet is that it is Teddy.
Oh God, you're probably
she's
right.
She's got those but, that basket full of marbles that she's leaving.
I know, but we saw Teddy in the Eden in the Forge, right? He's in there near the end of that episode. Unless
that's a backup of him, or it's something
God.
They already had.
Oh no.
I don't know. That's the thing. Like, I love these sci-fi setups because I think they're both thematically rich and just kind of neat. But it means you can always just chalk it up to some technical wizardry, and it bends to fit the plot as needed.
Yeah. Elsie doesn't get to do much. She's found in a cave, and then she gets shot unceremoniously, which I saw coming a million miles away. I don't know how you couldn't see that coming a million miles away.
She already cheated death once. She might cheat it again.
I mean, I don't. I always thought she had lived. I didn't. You know, we never saw her die. Like,
I guess we see in season one the flashback of Bernard strangling her in the same way that he was strangling Teresa when he killed Teresa. So I thought there was a pretty clear implication that she died, even if we didn't see it, like, see a body.
Until I see
it. I know it's precarious.
Yeah, considering that we see bodies at times and those people still come back, if I don't even see a body, I'm going to be a little like, they're fine. They got conked on the head. They're okay. Whatever. They're going to have little birdies dancing and then they'll be fine. Just shake it off.
I need a Krusty the Clown-esque signed affidavit that they're not coming back before I'll buy it.
Don't think you're going to be getting any of those from this show. I don't know. What is on your notes? What have we not touched on?
One thing that is a very small scene, but that I loved, is getting Giancarlo Esposito, a.k.a. Gus Fring from Breaking Bad, as Elazo, telling the man in black that this is his game and that he can't cheat at it. Like, I think, again, one of the great stories of Westworld is, or the recurring stories of Westworld, is great actors taking material that maybe is or is not up to snuff and knocking it out of the park. And I thought that scene could have played really hammy and really weak, and that Esposito just completely owned it. It makes it chilling and unnerving and exciting in a way that is a tall order given the circumstances.
I mean, that's the kind of stuff that the show does really well, is this. And I think that kind of that is, it's almost a referencing back. Like, there's a lot of those scenes with the Men in Black in particular, because it's a lot of him referencing the time he spent in the park. And he knows all these characters. You know, he knows who El Lazo is. He knows Lawrence. He's probably both been a partner to and killed Lawrence and his family dozens and dozens of times. You know, it doesn't mean anything to him the way, you know, we see Lawrence get kind of awoken by Maeve near the end of the season. Was it episode 8 or something? But to the Man in Black, it's just, hey, this is just another guy, and I can, you know, this is just, these aren't real people. These are robots, and I can manipulate them how I want. I know how to do it, because it's like Bill Murray in Groundhog Day. You know, he's done it so many times. He knows every permutation of how things can possibly play out. And
it's a good comparison.
The that scene in particular is just another example of, it's not going to work anymore. These familiar characters are not going to follow their stories anymore. You know, and it's just it gets reinforced over and over and over again. And it's not just him. It's, you know, Dolores and the Confederados. It is Maeve and in Shogun World, of her interactions with those characters. We are given example after example of not just, hey, these robots are awake now and they're functionally people. It is, these robots it's not that simple. You know, it's complicated that they might not just be awake, they might be broken, like the Shogun himself was, you know, or they, like El Lazo, who will, I don't know if El Lazo was awake at that point, but clearly not playing by this old rules of Westworld.
The game is different now, and there's a lot of people going off script.
Right. And it's, and, you know, it is building an atmosphere of danger of, and that's the thing I do regret, is that first season, it felt dangerous. Everything felt dangerous. Like, at a certain point, you start realizing, oh, the hosts they can't really die because they just get reset and rebuilt and they're fine. But whenever there were humans around, like when that twist of Bernard killing Teresa, and you're like, oh, this is dangerous. These people, this is an incredibly dangerous situation when these robots don't have fail safes anymore. And I feel like that it's starting to get, we joked about it like a dozen times already about, oh, no one's going to die. Everyone's safe. Everyone comes back to life when it's convenient. It kind of erases a little bit of the danger that I felt Westworld season one did have, at least. You know, it felt like if you're human, you are extraordinarily vulnerable. And who dies in this? Elsie? I guess Hale dies.
Hale, theoretically, but
yeah,
there's another kind of Hale out there. I mean, Teresa dies legitimately. She's thus far, I think, the only person of note who's kicked the bucket and not made a subsequent appearance.
Right. And that I appreciate that. The fact they didn't bring Teresa back, even though Teresa was a good character. I like Teresa a lot in season one. Like even Teddy, like that moment, like that I really liked that moment of Teddy, of him killing himself, because even though the execution you could argue is not rushed, probably the change in Teddy was probably too drastic in too short of time, of him flipping bad and then immediately, and then within two episodes being good again, being good again enough to realize, oh, well, I have to kill myself or she'll just keep doing this to me. But he's not dead, you know, not really, because he's probably one of those balls she took, or he's in the Eden world, which at least is an ending. I also worry about how many characters are they going to have in season three if they don't kill anyone.
I guess we killed off Mustache Strike Force guy, so you don't have to.
Carl.
He was the greatest of all.
Carl Strand? tall, bald, evil guy.
Oh, wait, there were two. There was the one.
Oh, you mean the Irish guy, I think, or Scottish?
Maybe Welsh. That guy, and there's the off-brand Corey Stoll who shows up this season.
They both bite it. I guess some of the other hosts do die permanently. Clementine,
maybe.
I that's true. They're all in piles at the end, and they can all get salvaged.
And they're all in some backup to a backup to a backup somewhere. I mean,
yeah. Stubbs is definitely a host, right?
I don't know. I mean,
speech at the end there, he lets Hale go when it's not Hale, when it's Dolores Hale.
I thought it was just implying that he knew that she was a host, but his job was to protect the hosts or something like that.
Hosts,
like, I guess.
Protect the hosts in the park.
Yeah. I took it as him having lost his faith in Westworld and thinking maybe that Dolores was right, or that at least whatever was, like, he knew what was up and thought she deserved to have her exit.
But how would he know that?
I don't know. How does anybody know anything on the show?
They have Bernard.
I'm not gonna pull on threads. I'm going to let the whole sweater unravel.
I mean, how do people know things? They have Bernard. They lock Bernard down and make him sit in a chair, and then they keep asking him questions while they make him suffocate himself, apparently.
Just like in real life.
Just like in real life, I guess.
It's sad, because it's true.
Yeah. I don't know. I think, ultimately, it's that unevenness that bothers me, because I didn't have that feeling in season one. I didn't have like, oh, this feels incredibly uneven. This feels like pointless meandering or whatever until you get to the meat. I was like, I like everything. I enjoyed being in that world. I enjoyed discovering what Westworld, the park was, and then discovering what all these little pieces were and then moving in and how they fit together. And this has those high points of seeing, you know, seeing James Delos and seeing young William interact with him and chase down his past. And like, that's really good up to the point where it isn't. It has I think the episode with Akechua and Kiksuya, that's a tremendous episode, like, and entirely divorced. Really? Entirely divorced from it is a theme piece, a mood piece, a character study that sure it colors a little bit about, you know, the background of the park and everything, but it's really like, I don't know. They managed to turn like what was up until that point a really borderline offensive portrayal of Native Americans. Like, as much as you can say, oh, they just do that because the people in the park, they want cowboys and Indians. You know, they want, you know, the savage whatever to kill or to deal with. You know, they want that stereotype. But still, when you don't give them any background details about it, makes you look bad. And in this episode, like, single-handedly managed to recapture that and make all these people actual characters and makes that their story as fascinating as anyone's. It makes them trying to find this door, like, of their reason for trying to get to the Valley Beyond is immediately the one that I am invested in the most. And that's the eighth episode of the season. And immediately I'm like, I don't, you know, I've known Dolores and Maeve and Bernard and all these people for much longer times. And the Ghost Nation has always been this boogeyman that they've kind of painted. That's been at the edges of the picture for a long time. And then immediately I'm like, well, I want his journey. I want to know it. I want to know what happens to them. I want to see them get to this other door. I want to see them get to the Valley Beyond. And that's an achievement. That's very good. And
especially for doing it in a single hour.
Right. Manages to and connect a lot of threads that were kind of tenuous in different ways, and then enables further storytelling with Maeve and her story with her daughter. It even actually retroactively got me more connected to Maeve and her daughter because of the way they end up interacting. And I'm still looking forward to season three. I'm still interested. I am curious. Like, now there's no net anymore, because now they're in the real world, theoretically.
Maybe.
Oh, God. Maybe.
We'll see.
I it could be anything. You know, there are no rules anymore. There's no park anymore to worry about, even though I assume there still will be some park.
Well, let me ask you this, Robbie. If your excitement level for season two was at, let's say, a 10, 10 out of 10 following season one.
Okay.
Where is your excitement level for season three, having now finished watching season two?
Like 6 or 7?
It's a pretty steep drop. So that's a lot of points to lose in one season.
Yeah, it's I don't know. We've spent a lot of time criticizing the show, but I still enjoyed it. I still liked watching it, and it certainly doesn't infuriate me as much as Star Trek Discovery did.
Not a high bar.
No, not necessarily. But I'm still really invested in these characters, and I want to know, like, the post credits William as, like, I already kind of, that was the thing that actually didn't really surprise me, is that, you know, as soon as they showed that, oh, William going down this elevator is at a different time than Bernard, I immediately went, and then they show him at the end be where he is being tested for fidelity, and he is I guess his own mind in a host body. I presume that's what we're being told. That's fascinating to me. I'm interested. I want to see, like, that. Hey, maybe that explains some of his behavior, because he's breaking literally
he's the Shogun.
Yeah. And I don't know I'm still fascinated. I want to see, like, now that they're not constrained by having to get people out of Westworld, What does season three look like? Does it involve them going hunting down the Delos Corporation or whatever? Like, are they going to engage in espionage? Like, it could be anything. Like, is it going to still be a Western? Like, who knows? Like, that's fascinating to me. And, like, the problem is I'm more interested in, like, broader than how Dolores does or anything like that. You know, it's more of like questions about the theme in the show than any individual characters, because they've kind of ended, like, I feel like they've reached the end of the arcs of a lot of these characters. And now Dolores and Bernard are Professor X and Magneto.
It's a legitimate question. What does this show look like after what we've already seen? Where do you take these stories after where you leave them here? And I don't know what the answer is. I hope. I feel like my consistent experience with Westworld has been that their premise and the idea for their stories and the situations that they craft are endlessly fascinating and so thematically rich. And the execution on them is always uneven, where one might be brilliant and the other might leave me with my face in my palm. But I do like those setups enough to keep watching, so they must be doing something right.
I think it's pretty ripe. And I think my only other point of the thing that changed between season one and season two, and it's not anything the show has done, is merely my appetite for shows about how brutal humans are is way down. First, I'm not nearly as interested in let's have a show about look how bad people are and we're robots are better. Or just as bad, even in Dolores' case, where she's like this bloodthirsty monster now. And
let's escape from the real world and watch this pleasing show about a mother being separated from her child.
Yeah, it's a lot of that. And that's nothing the show did. It's not the show's fault for that. It's just, you know, I'm more and more, I just kind of want stuff that gives me warm and fuzzies and doesn't remind me of how bad things actually are. But again, not Westworld's fault. It is what it is.
It's the truth.
If it is the same thing in season, let's say, 7 or 8, then it is their fault. But I don't know how long the show's going to go, so we'll see. If it makes a season 7 or 8, I'd be very impressed, honestly.
They'd have to reinvent themselves pretty significantly to get that far, but
yeah.
Stranger things have happened.
Stranger things have happened. Like Stranger Things.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Anything we haven't touched on, Andrew?
I think we got it.
All right. Where before we go, where can people find the things you do on the internet?
Well, people can find all of my writing from all across the web at my website, which is theandrewblog.net. That's 3 words, theandrewblog.net. You can also find my work on the expanded TV and film section of Consequence of Sound. If you like things written by Jonathan Nolan, then we've got a piece going up soon about the legacy of Heath Ledger's Joker in The Dark Knight that should be going up pretty quickly here. And you can find me on Twitter at the Andrew Blog. So thank you, as always, for having me, Robbie. And I can assure you that I'm the actual Andrew Bloom and not some kind of robot substitute.
I mean, if I can't tell the difference, why does it matter?
If it's real, what is the line? If you can't tell the difference, does it really matter? Is that
if you're going to say what is the line, it's also the thing that is real is that is which is irreplaceable, which if you can't tell the difference, that's pretty bad then, because that means it is replaceable.
Uh-oh, well now I feel bad.
Oh no, it's all of us. I think the show has, I think, pretty clearly outlined people are very simple, dumb, stupid things, and we're all replaceable. By hosts with books in them or something. Again, we can't.
Grim view of things to come.
Yeah, all right. Andrew, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Andrew for joining me. You can find me on Twitter at Robbie Dorman. The show's website is HeroFanaticist.com. Please, if you like the show, give it a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, subscribe, tell your friends, all that good stuff. It helps us out, helps the show out, helps me out. I appreciate anyone who takes the time. Until next time, thanks for being a fan.